We're doing Parshas Baalozcha, and last night we did the first two-thirds, first 70% of the parsha. We learned about the laws of lighting the menorah. We learned about the trumpets. We learned about the Levite's inauguration. We learned about the custom we have of shaving all the hair before immersing in the mikvah when one is converting or doing tshuva for adopting paganism. We learned about the parsha that is in the middle of our parsha, the two psukim that have a status of their own parsha and the halachic ramifications of those 85 letters defining for us what is the holiness of a Sefer Torah with a minimum of 85 letters. And we learned about the nation's complaint that in Egypt it used to be so easy, you could pick up so many girls easily, meaning it was easy to find a wife from your own family because they were less limited as to who they could marry, and so marriage was easier and cheaper. And now they couldn't marry so cheaply. They had to marry a girl who was not such a close relative because more relatives were prohibited. And those girls suddenly wanted a stake and they were higher maintenance. And the people said, this marriage is getting expensive on us and difficult on us, and the women have higher demands on us. This isn't like marrying an aunt. This isn't like marrying the relatives which we were permitted to marry back when we were in Egypt. And so they were complaining about the laws of marriage. And we discussed how ever since then, in Judaism, we find that when couples are prepared to wed, different fights erupt, and our sages saw it as directly connected, that we didn't accept these mitzvot with joy, but rather with quarreling. And so too, throughout our history, marriages have always involved a certain amount of quarreling about how to divide the money and where the couple's going to live and whatever other details the parents have to fight about. So the nation is complaining. The man is so dry. The man is the only food we have. And the Torah describes how some people would get the man to their doorstep, some people would get the man further out, and some people would actually have to spend a large amount of time until they harvested the man. And that was depending on a person's merits. The more merits a person had, the more the man was closer to his doorstep. And Moshe turns to God and says, why have you done this to me? You've given me a responsibility I can't handle. These aren't my kids. You're telling me to carry them like a kasher yisa ha'omein et hayonek. Just as a parent or someone who adopts a child carries the nursing baby, why am I responsible to carry them like this? So they're not my kids, so to speak. They're your kids. Where am I going to give them this much meat? They ask me for meat. I can't do this alone. God tells Moshe, okay, gather 70 people, the elders of the nation, and you bring them into the Ohel Moed. Take them out of the camp to the Ohel Moed. They will stand with you there. I will descend and speak to you there, and then I will take from the spirit that is upon you and place it upon them. So there's a danger. If we have many leaders to the Jewish people, then you could end up with a Congress that's deadlocked, right? The Republicans always outvote the Democrats. The Democrats outvote the Republicans. You can't go anywhere because everyone's pulling in the other direction. Even if their intent is not to win favor in the eyes of the people, the nature of 70 different leaders is that each one will have their own stress, and it's very hard to get anywhere with that. So how do we overcome that? And here we have a famous drasha speech of the Ran, where the Ran discusses what is the best form of government. Which type of government does Judaism espouse? And the Ran says that everyone would agree that a monarchy is the best form of government, provided that it is a kind monarch. Meaning, he isn't being Machiavellian here. He's saying, if you can have a leader who is Moshe Rabbeinu, if you can have a leader who is, his sole intent is the benefit of the people, he's not focused on his own ego. On the contrary, he is the most modest leader, he is the wisest leader, and he is interested in hearing what people have to say. He's humble enough to take counsel. He's humble enough to appoint other leaders. But it's all under his jurisdiction. So then your best bet is having a monarch, because he could get things done. The only reason that democracy has to, we need a democratic system, is to protect the individuals from the monarchs which are really corrupt, from the monarchs that are going to abuse their power or who don't legitimately have the right to that power. They shouldn't be in the position of leadership. But in truth, a democracy is really a hindrance. You cannot, look at what's happening now. You have a situation where the Muslims throughout Europe are taking advantage of the democracy to overturn the countries against their own people. I'll give you an example. It's not nice to make the comparison, but there was a shul in a certain city where the founders of the shul were with a certain philosophy in life. And as they were aging, young people came into town with a very different philosophy. And the youngsters got membership in the shul. And before the elders knew what was happening, they had a majority of the board, and they voted out all the elders from the board, and they changed all the rules of the shul, and they took over the shul. They didn't lay a penny, but through the democratic system of the shul, these youngsters were able to overtake the shul. Legally, the shul is theirs. And then they put in their own rules in the shul. Those elders were kicked out. They couldn't come back in. I mean, they could dominate in the shul, but they couldn't enter the board. And now they have a shul that's legally theirs. Legally, they didn't do a thing to build the shul. And there was nothing in the declarations of the shul insisting that it maintain its nature and its style and its philosophy. So they did it. They took over the shul. The same thing is happening now in Europe. I mean, it's well known that Holland won on the Muslim vote. So it's only a matter of time. You know, statistically, if they keep having 5, 7, 8 children in a family, and the French, the regular French, only have 2 or 3 kids per family, well, in another decade, a decade and a half, they'll take over France. And it's not only France, it's throughout the world. So a democracy has certain weaknesses. In a monarchy, well, that a monarchy also has weaknesses that can be exploited by the vicious monarch. But if you have a kind monarch and you have a system where the monarch is under the auspices of the prophet, well, then you can have a monarchy, and that's the best system. He doesn't have to take anyone's advice. He can get things done. So the Ran then questions, well, why is Moshe getting 70 other people with him? Won't that hinder him? How can Moshe succeed? So the Ran takes us to a story in Melachim. In Kings, it is described that the Aramean king would send his troops and they would prepare an ambush for the Jewish soldiers. And every time they'd prepare an ambush, the prophet Elisha would send word to the king, warn your soldiers, over by that mountain, if you look closely, there's a battalion waiting to pounce on your soldiers. They'd get together their troops and they would pounce on the ambush and they'd overtake the ambush. This happened once, it happened twice, it happened a third time. It reached a point where the Aramean king called in all his advisors, he called in the chief of staffs and said, we have a spy in our midst because the Jews are figuring out all our plans before we even do them. And the advisors said, no, there's no spy. Rather, they have a prophet named Elisha. And the prophet Elisha, well, he knows the things you whisper to your wife in your bedroom. He knows everything. You can't hide anything from him. So the king said, if that's the case, bring me Elisha. So he's the one we have to get. So they send a large contingency to surround Elisha's house. And it's the middle of the night. And the lad comes in and tells Elisha, Aho Adoni, whoa, my master, we're in trouble. Come out, look at what's happening. And they walk outside and they see that all around his house, there are troops surrounding his house. So the lad is very worried, and Elisha isn't worried at all. So he turns to Elisha and says, why aren't you worried? And Elisha prays, and he says, God, please reveal his eyes. Let him see what's going on. And his prayer is answered, and the lad looks around, and he sees that beyond the soldiers, all around the hilltops, the mountains surrounding them are all loaded with soldiers and chariots of fire. Now you know where the term comes from. So he sees a huge army of soldiers all made of fires. He sees all these angels surrounding Elisha, protecting him. And then now when he looks at the Aramean soldiers, they look they look petty. Now he understands why Elisha isn't worried. Now, you understand this is all a prophetic vision, because the continuation of the story is that all the Aramean soldiers go blind. So what did Elisha need all those battalions surrounding his house for? If they all go blind, and then Elisha comes up to them and says, this isn't the man, and this isn't the city, this isn't where you guys belong, follow me. And they all follow him, and he brings them to the center, to the capital, and he calls the Jewish king, and he says, here are the men. And then the men are given their eyesight back, and suddenly they find themselves in the center of town, surrounded by soldiers, in front of the Jewish king. And the Jewish king asks Elisha, should I kill him? So wait a second, Elisha didn't use all those soldiers. He had all these angels all around his house protecting him, and that's not what he used. So the simple understanding is that those soldiers were not physical soldiers of fire. This was a prophetic vision. It was something he was showing the lad, that we have protection from above, the equivalent of an army of fire. But it wasn't literal. So what's going on here? How come the lad gets a prophetic vision? Because Elisha prayed for it. But if he wasn't worthy, how did he get prophecy? So the Ran tells us a concept which he illustrates in numerous places in Tanakh, that this is the concept, especially in our parsha. The Ran says, if you have someone standing in one place and they get a prophetic vision, then the guy standing right next to them, even if he's not worthy, can have a spillover effect. He can get prophecy even though he's not worthy of it. And that's what Elisha was praying for. He says, God, you're giving me the prophecy to see all around, to see all the angels protecting me. Let it spill over onto him. Let him also see what's going on here. When God tells Moshe, go with the people, go with the 70 elders, and then I'll speak to you. And when I speak to you, your spirit will spread onto them. So what Hashem is saying is that these 70 elders aren't worthy of prophecy. You see, they weren't prophets a day earlier. But then they get Moshe's spirit. There's this spillover effect from Moshe onto the other elders. And that's why Moshe doesn't have to be concerned, because the elders realize that their whole prophecy stems from Moshe. So there's no questioning whether Moshe is the leader or not. None of them were worthy of prophecy, but they all knew they got their prophecy by virtue of standing next to Moshe. And that's now when we read the verses, they make a lot of sense. What does Hashem say? I will descend, I will speak to you, and I will shine the spirit that's on you, and I will place it on them. Ah, now it makes sense. I will multiply the spirit that's on you. I will shine it onto them as well. Now maybe we should expand this to where the Ran expands it. The Ran says it's not only a concept that applies to human beings. The Ran says there are also objects that can absorb spirituality and affect onward. So let's take an example. There was a hospital that was highly successful, and after a period, they started noticing that patients admitted to the hospital were dying. Now, the treatment seemed to be as successful, and the doctors seemed to be as skilled. So they couldn't figure out why were patients dying at an unusual pace in that hospital. And after doing some research, they realized that the walls of the hospital were made of wood. And the walls had absorbed so many germs that when patients came in with one ailment, by the time they were ready to leave, they had many other ailments that had been absorbed into the walls of the hospital. So this same idea that we see in the physical world, we also find in the spiritual world. Things can become absorbed of spirituality. And the Ran says, we will see in a few weeks, God tells Moshe to go talk to the rock. We no longer have water, and we have to go and the miracle has to start again, where water will spill out of this rock. So God tells Moshe, go talk to the rock. And we all know that Moshe erred and hit the rock, right? But let's go back to the parasha. God tells Moshe, take the staff with you and go talk to the rock. Well, if Moshe's job is to talk to the rock, why did God tell him, take the staff with you? If you look at the parasha, you'll see it says that. says the Ran, that staff was a staff which was used to do many miracles from the onset of Moshe's mission. And so that staff, so to speak, was absorbed with spirituality. And where that staff was present, it had an impact around it. It's not only a person that's spiritual that affects the people around them. It's also an object, even a staff. You know, there are people who got a dollar from the Rebbe. Yeah. And they have it framed in their house. There are different applications to this concept. But at any rate, coming back to our parasha. So that's the great concept that Ran develops revolving around the 70 elders in our parasha. So the people get this special bird. It's unclear what this slav was. According to some commentaries, it was a fish that had wings. We know today we have fish like that. There are different types of birds that swim and fish that fly, however you want to call them. So it was this fat bird. It says that when they used to bake it, it had so much fat that you could smear it on, I don't remember, I think 16 or 18 loaves of bread. You could smear with the fat that dripped from this bird as you'd cook it. So it was a very, very fat bird. Now Moshe asks a question. He says, I have 600,000 foot soldiers here. You're offering us meat for a month. How exactly is this going to happen? Are we slaughtering sheep or cattle or fish? How are we doing this? And God tells Moshe, you question my capacity? You'll see. Now, some of the commentaries say that this was Moshe's big sin, where Moshe questioned God. Moshe said, how's this going to happen? And God says, you really think something's beyond me? So then, why isn't this stressed? Either because this was a private conversation between Moshe and Hashem, as opposed to the sin of hitting the rock, which was public, and that's why that's considered his great sin. Or else others suggest that God made a big deal of the rock so that it wouldn't be overtly understood that this was his big sin. The hitting the rock seems minuscule when you think about it. And God didn't want to say, this is the big deal. God covered this up so we wouldn't walk around and say, you see, even Moshe had a question. How's God going to make things work? Okay, whatever the interpretation is, Moshe gathers the 70 elders. We know the story that two people remained inside the camp and technically they should have exited, and they got their prophecy, and Moshe's lad, which is Yoshua, who is also an old man, runs out and says, Eldad and Medad are prophesizing in the camp. Now, let's go back to the Ran. If the whole idea of the prophecy was that every prophet knows they're getting their prophecy from Moshe, when you have two people inside the camp getting their prophecy, you understand that now you have a problem. Because now Moshe has competition, and that's why Yoshua panics. He says, imprison them. You can't have this two prophets walking around and saying, God told us this, and it was worse. What were they saying? They were saying, Moshe's going to die and Yeshua's leading the people into Israel. So they said a true prophecy. But when Yeshua heard it, Yeshua said, what are we doing now? Now you have two prophets who have their own prophecy. So Moshe, how are you going to run the people like this? You got to jail them. And Moshe says, no, don't worry about me. I wish everyone were prophets. So, yes.
Can you explain when Moshe was questioning about the meat and like how that they would be fed, exactly what that means? Because the way that you're describing it, it sounds like Shem says so, assuming that he can somehow have a conversation with Hashem, and say, so is it going to be that we build a temple, or it's going to fall from the sky, or both? That he's asking a question of what's, you know, and this is like another Ra, that he's asking how the event is going to unfold. It seems sort of like a basic, normal kind of question, and not like a plan to...
From somebody on his level, it's different, though.
I didn't follow. What's your question?
What exactly... How did Moshe say this, that it was a frontier? Just question how an event is going to unfold.
You're asking according to that pshat? Meaning we offered more than one pshat. So which pshat are you going with?
That by asking how Hashem is going to feed the multitude, the 600,000 foot soldiers, and are they going to have to slaughter sheep to feed them, or are they going to something else? What was the sin in that?
So you want to understand that pshat, which I think is the pshat the Malbim goes with. I don't remember if it's the Malbim or the Torah Tamima. So remind me later, we'll come back to that, okay? I want to, if we're going to go into detail, I want to quote it inside. So just remind me later tonight, because Hashem will come back to it. I don't remember if it's the Malbim or the Torah Tamima. I have in mind that it's the Malbim. What are you asking me? Where is it in the parasha?
Yeah,
what's called the 11th chapter, the 22nd pasuk. 21st, 22nd pasuk. Okay. Okay. Onward. So
it's fair in the just the shot of what he said, it sounds that way.
Yeah. Okay. We come to the end of the parasha. And we have an interesting story. So our story really begins with a little girl who has the goal to come to her father and say, "You're worse than Pharaoh. Pharaoh commanded that the boys get thrown into the Nile, and you divorced mom, so there won't be any boys or girls. You're worse than Pharaoh." And her father says, "You got a point." And he remarries his wife, and when they have the wedding, so the two kids, Miriam and Aaron, are both dancing at the wedding. She's with her tambourine, and they're celebrating with their parents that they get remarried. And then, when the Moshe's born, and everyone's rejoicing, and Miriam, this little girl, has a prophecy, she tells her dad, "You will have a great leader who will save the Jewish people." And then when Moshe is born and they see what an unusual baby he is, he kisses her on the head and says, "Wow, your prophecy came true, Miriam." 3 months later, they see they aren't succeeding in keeping Moshe hidden, and the Egyptian decree hasn't passed. And they realize that it's going to take a short amount of time before the Egyptians are going to come and discover Moshe. And they put Moshe in a casket in the reeds by the edge of the Nile. And as they're doing that, her father taps her on the head and says, "Where's your prophecy now?" and spits in her face. And Miriam's completely embarrassed. And when they put Moshe in the Nile among the reeds, so Miriam stands at a distance behind the tree. She's walking not too far behind. She's keeping an eye on her baby brother. And we know the continuation of the story. Moshe grows up in the home together with Miriam and Aaron. His mother is being paid to nurse her. And then when he's old enough, he goes up to grow up in the palace. Fast forward 80 years later, he's 80 years old. God appears to him out in Midian and tells him, "Time to go back. You got to take the Jews out of Egypt." And Moshe says, "No." And God says, "Yes." And Moshe says, "Please send someone else." And God says, "You." For 7 days, this conversation is going on. Back and forth and back and forth. Moshe repeatedly refuses. Why? Because Moshe knows his father was the leader of the Jewish people. And while he's been away, his brother Aaron has been the leader of the Jewish people. So Moshe, out of his love for a brother who he hardly knew, right? He didn't grow up with Aaron. At age 2 or 3, at a relatively young age, he moved to Pharaoh's palace. But he doesn't want to take the position away from Aaron. Moshe, please. You always sent Aaron to lead the people. Keep sending him. Until God finally says, no, you're going to go and you're going to be the leader. Enough is enough. And don't worry about your brother Aaron, because I'm telling you that when he sees that you're the new leader, v'samach b'libo, he will be happy in his heart. Could you imagine that a big brother who's accustomed to being the leader sees the little brother taking his position, usurping him, and he's happy, and God attests that he's happy in his heart. He's really happy. What a heart. What a tremendous person Aaron was. And so the Medrash says that when we say, Hinei matov umanaim shevet achim gam yachad, what a wondrous, what a beautiful thing it is when two brothers sit together. The example of brotherly love is Moshe and Aaron. So imagine, we're traveling through the desert, and our leaders are two brothers who really show brotherly love, and their sister leads the women. Now, there's a little conversation that takes place. Miriam speaks to Moshe's wife, Tzipora, and Tzipora asks her, how come I see all these candles lit? So Miriam tells her, well, there were new prophets who were given prophecy, and in celebration, each tribe lit a few candles in their honor, and that's all the candles that you see around here. That's lights that were lit in honor of this occasion. So Tzipora says, I feel bad for their wives. They're not going to have any more kids. So Miriam says, why? What do you mean? So Tzipora says, well, I know what Moshe's been like ever since he got prophecy. He doesn't know what it means to sleep in bed with me. He hasn't slept in bed ever since he got prophecy. So we're not going to have any more kids. So I'm happy that there are more prophets in the world. I just feel bad for their wives because they're not going to have any more kids. So Miriam says, that's interesting. She goes to her brother Aaron and says, Aaron, you know, I haven't left my husband. Have you left your wife? Am I missing something? When we get prophecy, we're supposed to leave our spouses? Now, Aaron and Miriam were having this conversation when both had been with their spouses only a few hours earlier. They had both been intimate. And so they were both defiled, tumas keri. And Aaron says to Miriam, gee, I don't get it. God didn't speak to Moshe alone. He also spoke to us. And even before Moshe was born, Miriam was a prophet. Remember? Miriam said, my mother's going to have a son who's going to save the Jewish people. God hears the conversation. So Aaron and Miriam, who are the big brother and sister, have a relatively innocent conversation about Moshe. But there was something missing there. What happens when we say Lashon Hara? What we're doing is we're judging the person from our vantage point. There was a guy on a train with his son, and the kid is getting all excited. And the kid is 22 years old, and he says, Dad, Dad, as the train's moving, all the buildings are moving backwards. The father smiles warmly at the kid, and a few minutes later, the kid turns to his dad and says, Dad, Dad, it's amazing. Even the birds can't keep up with this train. And the father smiles again. And someone sitting next to the kid turns to the father and says, you know, maybe your kid should be seen by a doctor. So the father says, oh yeah, he's needed a doctor for a long time. And right now, we're just coming back from the hospital, and my 22-year-old son just finished surgery, which allows him for the first time in his life to see. End of story. So you sit there and you see a 22-year-old young man and you think the guy's retarded. He's getting excited over things that should be obvious to him. Suddenly you get another piece of the puzzle and you realize, oh boy, I didn't understand what I was seeing here. When we speak Lashon Hara, what we're doing is we're assuming I know what's going on by the other person. I know enough that I can judge the other person and come to conclusions about the other person and speak about the other person. So even a conversation that's relatively innocent, Aaron and Miriam are speaking about Moshe. And they're saying, we also got prophecy. True. And we didn't leave our spouses. True. But where's the falsehood and all that? They think they understand Moshe. And that's where even siblings who mean well can end up talking Lashon Hara. So it's a minuscule, it's really minuscule, their sin. But God doesn't let it pass. And what God does is God appears suddenly to all three of them. Moshe is out of the picture. He hasn't been there. God appears to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam and says, all three of you, out to Ohel Moed now. Aaron and Miriam are defiled. Both of them have been with their spouses and haven't been to mikvah, and they both feel terrible. Suddenly they're not, they spiritually are yelling, we can't handle this. God, wait. But God doesn't wait. And God appears with a pillar of cloud and calls out, Aaron, Miriam. And they step forward. And God says, Shim'una devarai. What does the word na mean? Listen now what I have to say. If there's any other prophet, I appear to them in a vision. I appear to them in a dream. Moshe, my servant, is not like that. He's trusted throughout my house. I speak to him directly. He sees a direct vision. No illusions. No visions. He sees exactly what I'm showing him. How were you not fearful to speak so about my servant Moshe? Wow. Yismach Moshe b'matnat chelko ki eved ne'eman karata lo. God finishes his speech. And then he's angry at them, and Aaron and Miriam are both covered with leprosy. Aaron turns to Miriam, and ordinarily wherever Aaron would look, Aaron looks at himself, and all the whiteness fades from him onto Miriam. Miriam is covered with her own whiteness plus Aaron's whiteness. And Aaron looks at her. And Aaron was accustomed that anyone he looked at, he was so loving that they were healed spiritually and even their tzaras would pass. And when Aaron looks at Miriam, nothing doing. He can't get her tzaras to pass. And Aaron was of the opinion that a brother cannot rule on his sister's blemish. A relative cannot rule. So Aaron turns to Moshe and says she's going to die because no one can cure her. My master, he says to Moshe, now he speaks to him differently. He says, don't hold this against us. We were stupid. We made a mistake. But don't let her die. And Moshe draws a circle in the sand and says, God, please cure her. I am not leaving this circle in the sand until you answer me that you've cured her. And that's the first time we see the story of a person drawing a circle in the sand. And Hashem says, when her father spat in her face as a child, wasn't she embarrassed for 7 days? There's an issue of her own feeling. She should be embarrassed. She'll spend the 7 days out of the camp and then she'll come back. So Miriam, who was an old woman by now, probably about 83, 84, all her life she was sick. All her life, she had skin issues. And all her life, no one wanted to marry her because she didn't look too nice. And she was sickly. She had a husband named Kalev. And he married her for the sake of heaven. He said, if she is the sister of Moshe and Aaron, I am marrying her, even though she was 40 years his senior. He was in his 40s, she was in her 80s. But he married her because he said, only good can come of this. And we see that the two were intimate a few hours earlier. Remember? She was defiled. That means that even though she was an old woman, they were still having relations. And all these years, Kalev had been taking care of Miriam for the sake of heaven. Because he believed that if he marries her, only good can come of it. Because she, if her two brothers are the leaders of the Jewish people, then she's a woman worth marrying. And he's in love with her, in spite of all her blemishes. At the end of the 7 days, not only is Miriam cured of her tzaras, she walks out of that and she is the most beautiful woman. She comes out of that, she can win any beauty contest. She is not only cured of her blemishes, she's cured of all her illnesses. And now Kalev gets a wife where everyone went crazy over her. People would see her in the street and they'd start slopping at the mouth, and they'd run home to their wives and say, honey, let's go out together. They'd get all excited because she was such a beauty. This was the nice end of the story. And after this, Miriam was cured and could have children, and she had many children. And that's the nice end to the story that the Talmud derives from verses in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles. So everyone, the whole nation, waited until Miriam rejoined the camp. Now, we have to analyze this story with a little bit more depth, but first I see there are comments. Yes?
There's so many issues with this story that are just so horrible and painful and make no sense. Amram is like, he's like the Gadol Ador of that generation. He was not enslaved, so he was not they were not idolaters, right?
Right.
How does someone like that spit in the face of like a 7-year-old prophet girl?
Okay.
Totally, completely baffled. And on top of it, he has the zchut and that Hashem, through him, Moshe Rabbeinu is born.
Now, one step at a time.
Two amazing, Aharon, Cohen, and
wait, so let's go one step at a time. There are two approaches to a question like that. I'll tell you a story. Okay? Story happened this week. A retarded woman walked into a base medrash and started collecting. And she walks over to one of the rabbis in the Beis Medrash and says, Rabbi, I'm supposed to get my check from Bituach Lumi next week. Can you give me a loan? So the rabbi asks her, what do you need the money for? So she says, I need to buy a pack of cigarettes. So the rabbi thinks for a minute and then tells her, how much money do you need to buy your pack of cigarettes? So she tells him, it costs 23 shekel and I have 10 shekel in my hand. So he tells her, fine. He gives her 50 and he says, go buy your pack of cigarettes and bring me back the change. So she stands there staring at him and she doesn't budge. So he asks her, what's the problem? So she says, you're making it too complicated for me. I'll go to someone else. So the rabbi says, wait. He goes over to someone else in the Beis Medrash, gets the change, gives her her 13 shekel, and says, look, when you get your check from Bituach Lumi, so you'll come by here, you'll pay it back. She says, thank you very much. She leaves the room. She goes to buy her pack of cigarettes. Someone who was sitting there in the Beis Medrash walks over to the rabbi and says, I have two questions. Number one, how could you help a retarded person buy a pack of cigarettes? Number two, if you were going to give her the money, why did you take your time thinking about it? Why? What's going on here? How'd you do that? Either give it to her or don't give it to her, but... What? So, before I continue the story, there are two approaches when you see something like that. If you know the person involved, and you know they're a good person and a kind person, and then you can look at it and say, what a stupid thing he did. Or you could say, maybe there's something here I didn't understand. Does the rabbi think he's going to get his money back? And if he doesn't think he's going to get his money back, why did he give her money to get cigarettes? And, right? So the story doesn't make sense. The question is, how do you view a story that doesn't make sense? Do you say, I give credit to the person involved, I know they're not stupid, and there must be a lodge here, and I must be missing something? Or do you say, okay, he's a dumbo, I won't ask him any questions anymore? You have a choice. So I was there when this person went over and asked the rabbi. So the rabbi said to him, well, the answer is like this. This retarded woman for 5 years has been walking into this Beis Medrash every day, putting a donation in our tzedakah box. She donates to this Beis Medrash every day for 5 years. So when this woman walks in and says, I need a loan, I think that part of what we owe her as a place that she's been donating to on a daily basis is to give her that loan. On the other hand, when I asked her what she needs it for, she said she needs it, she wants to buy cigarettes. So I stopped and I thought, is it right to help a woman buy cigarettes? I mean, she's hurting her health. Am I doing her a favor? And I was asking myself, if she doesn't have her check from Bituach Lumi, am I developing a bad habit in her to start taking loans? And then by the time she gets her check, then she'll already owe half of it to other people. And then I'm actually training her to enter a cycle of debt. So I wasn't sure if I'm doing her a favor by giving her her 13 shekel. So that's what I was pondering initially when she asked me for the loan. A, is it a favor to give her the money to buy the cigarettes? B, is it a favor to give her the money altogether because maybe she's going to get into a bad habit and I'm hurting her? Then she told me, never mind, I'm going to go collecting by other people. And I realized that in 2 minutes she'd get the loans from other people in the Beis Medrash anyways. So it's not like I'm the one that's getting her the cigarettes, she'd get them without me. And it's not like I'm the one getting her into this bad habit, she's going to get into it without me. So if that's the case, then I owe it to her, after she supported our yeshiva all these years, to give her the loan. So that's why I pondered it, and in the end I gave it to her. But suddenly you realize there was a lot of thought behind everything that seemed like a simple exchange between the rabbi and this woman. So I'm just saying, when you look at a story, there are two approaches to the story. One is you say, okay, this is stupid. Or you say, I know these people deserve a certain amount of credit, so I'm not going to be quick to jump to conclusions. And that's really the idea that Maimonides develops in his introduction to the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. Maimonides says, you will meet in your lifetime, you will encounter midrashim that seem ridiculous. And there are three approaches to those midrashim. One approach says, the rabbis didn't know what they were talking about, this is nonsense. So, okay, if you have a little bit of intelligence, you could analyze their works, and you'll see there's a lot of wisdom there, but there are certain things you don't understand. So then there's the second approach, which says, the rabbis were geniuses, they knew exactly what they were talking about, and if they said something that seems like nonsense to me, I must be stupid and they must be smart. The Rambam says that's stupid too, because you look at the Midrashim and you have to be honest and say, these Midrashim, well, I don't understand them. So then he says there's a third approach. The third approach says they were smart, and this Medrash I don't understand. I'm not just saying, oh, they knew everything and everything they said is accurate. No, they must have meant something beyond what I heard. There must be a deeper meaning here because I do have a certain amount of intelligence and I understand that on the surface this doesn't make sense. But being that I give them credit and I understand that they're very intelligent people, so then I say there must be more going on here than I understand. So that's, as a general approach, that's the approach Maimonides says we should have when we approach Midrashim that seem to make no sense. So far, are you with me? So now we have a few choices here. I would rather, on an educational level, to leave it as a question. So you get accustomed to the fact that you encounter Midrashim, which you don't always understand, but you'll get super annoyed if I do that to you. So maybe I shouldn't be an educator, I should just try to answer you. But I'm not sure that's educational.
No, if we have an answer, then fine. You can say, you know, look here, or I don't know, or we can talk about later, or whatever.
No problem. So learn Moed Katan Daf Tes Zayin. And then we'll discuss this again.
There's no answer, or, you know,
no, like, fine.
Masora about the, such a thing.
So I'm giving you, I'll give you three answers. There are three components to the answer. One is the Talmud and Tractate Moed Katan Daf Tes Zayin. Number two is the Nachmanides and his disciples and Rabbeinu Bechaye on the mitzvah of Chalitza, where they discuss on a spiritual level, what does it mean to spit? Why is it that part of the chalitza process involves spitting? And number three, I have to look it up. There's a Jerusalem Talmud that discusses the word klima versus busha. I think it's in Brachos, but I have to find it. And if we put the three together, then we suddenly will have a different picture as to the conversation that went on here. Meaning you're right. At first glance, how does a father spit in his daughter's face? You shouldn't spit in anyone's face. The Medrash says, "Kol hayorek b'fnei chavero en nochelek l'olam haba." If someone spits in someone else's face, they don't have a portion in the world to come. So you're right. The question should bother you. You're 100% right. At first glance, the Medrash seems to be very difficult. How could he spit in his daughter's face? But then we have to understand what's going on beyond the surface. But that deserves another 15 minutes. So let's hold off on it for now. It's a good question.
There seems to be a general vein of like actions that make no sense on the surface, but the people are still righteous and like extremely so all throughout the Tanakh.
Right, but that's partially because we don't understand the code. If you see that certain words appear in specific settings, such as Rabbi Akiva, who also spit, and that's the same Rabbi Akiva who wouldn't drink a cup of wine that someone else sipped from because he was so finicky. So how come he spit? I'm saying Rabbi Akiva was super finicky. He's the example of someone who, he was invited to a meal, the host said, Rabbi, have a drink. Baruch atah Hashem l'keinu melech haolam, baruch pri hagafen. Took us a drink and said, Rabbi Akiva, here you go. Rabbi Akiva said, no thanks. So the host said, oh, you probably want a better wine. Just a second. Goes and opens up second barrel, takes a cup. Baruch atah Hashem l'keinu melech haolam, baruch pri hagafen. Takes a sip. Rabbi, here you go. No thanks. Oh, this wasn't honorable enough? We'll get a third barrel. He goes to get his third barrel. And then Rabbi Yeshua tells him that, not Rabbi Yeshua, I don't remember, one of the disciples there tells him, wait, get the hint. He's not going to drink a cup you drank from. So, what's going on here? And Rabbi Akiva spit. Ah, so we have to understand what does it mean to spit. Again, when you look at things simply, they have one meaning. When you start understanding the code in the system, they have a different meaning. Yaakov walks into Haran and kisses his female cousin. How do you do that? First day he met her. That's a chutzpah. You just met your cousin for the first time?
Wasn't she three years old?
Okay, so if you say she's 3 years old, suddenly it looks a little different. Again, you have to understand the culture of the time. You have to understand that there are a few different terms for a kiss in Tanakh, and each one has a different meaning. You don't view it as strange if in French culture a woman extends her hand and the man is supposed to kiss it. That you can understand. But if you understand that in those days the same thing was the custom, and you understand that there's a nuance of one letter difference between a kiss that shows intimacy and a kiss that was a form of respect, and then you start looking through Tanakh and you see that it holds true throughout Tanakh, so you start understanding that, yes, there's a difference between Vayishak et and Vayishak li, and over here it says Vayishak li Rachel, just as by David HaMelech when he kissed Avshalom, it says Vayishak HaMelech li Avshalom and not et Avshalom, Vatishak Orpa lachamota. You'll suddenly see that every time it says Vayishak li, it's a distance. It's a kiss that, on the contrary, in their days showed, I don't dare come close to you because I respect you. It was a kiss that showed distance. So again, that's part of their culture, which you don't understand because you don't pick up the nuances if you haven't learned the details. I'm just bringing it as an example. So you're saying, yes, what's going on here? Aren't you just answering a question? No. There is a system, there is a code, and the more you learn, the more you discover that code. Me too. The more I learn, the more I discover that code too. To be discussed, that deserves an hour and a half answer. That deserves a separate class in and of itself. How does that work? That's another legitimate question. Okay.
What?
Another half hour. You're asking good questions, but each one deserves a long class. But now you know, on a Thursday night.
Come. Just all of your time
forever. Lat, okay. Yaakov. Let's ask two questions. Before Aaron speaks to Moshe, do we find that they ever express their remorse for what they did? And you can see this idea in a few places in the Torah. Let's go back in our own parsha. It says the nation was complaining, Hashem got upset, and the fire started consuming the edge of the camp. The nation yells to Moshe, and Moshe prays to Hashem, and the fire sinks. Wait a second. Why didn't Moshe daven before the nation turned to him? So, I think, I don't remember if I saw this explicitly anywhere. I think the simple understanding is that if they don't come and say, I'm sorry, so then they didn't do tshuva. What do you want from me? You know, and this is a concept which at first glance seems cruel, but at second glance seems Republican. Take responsibility. It's your life. If it's important to you to say, you know, I'm sorry, do something. Who says he has to take those steps towards them? Okay, so that's I think that's the simple answer. Even though I don't remember seeing that written overtly. And secondly, remember that Aaron and Miriam were told to advance. God's conversation with Aaron and Miriam was separate from Moshe. Doesn't say Moshe heard that. God tells Aaron and Miriam, come forward. So we don't have an indication that Moshe was even aware of it before Aaron turns to Moshe. So that might be another answer, why Aaron has to ask Moshe to pray. Okay, anything else? Yes.
Why did Aaron just look at her and give his reflection over to her?
I don't think the Medrash means that Aaron willfully threw all his tzaras on Miriam. I think what the Medrash means is that when Aaron turned to her, so then God made the tzaras leave him and go to Miriam. Vayifen Aaron el Miriam, I don't think it means Aaron did it, but rather somehow in heaven they did that, and the reasoning behind it was that Miriam initiated this whole conversation. There was an element of responsibility that Miriam had for everything that happened here. Okay. So we have to go into this parsha with a little bit more depth. Let's pause for a minute.